From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nearly 2,000 years ago, an Indian gentleman and scholar penned a book on how to love well, how to know passion and desire, and how to live well, how to keep it all in balance. That book was called the Kama Sutra. In modern times, we titter over it as an ancient sex manual. There is that. But there's a lot more. This hour on Point, the Kama Sutra on how to love and how to live. You can join the conversation on this Valentine's Day. Could you use a few tips on how to romance and cherish your loved one? How to balance your life, the work, and the pleasures? Have you read the Kama Sutra, the whole Kama Sutra? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Before we get started, a gentle warning to listeners across the country. It is the Kama Sutra. We're not doing the gymnastics here today, but there is adult discussion of sexuality in this book, so heads up. We will hear in a moment from an American translator of the Kama Sutra, Wendy Doniger. But first, joining us from Delhi, India, and we are delighted to have him, is Aditya Haksar, a distinguished former Indian diplomat. He has translated a number of works of ancient Sanskrit. And now, he has translated into English the Kama Sutra. Aditya Haksar, thank you very much for being with us from Delhi today. It's wonderful to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Tell us, first of all, how do people in your country think about this book today? Do they giggle about it as a sex manual, or do they see the broader context that you bring to us in your new translation?
Well, I should tell you straight away that views in India are very greatly now influenced by views which prevail all over the world. So there's not very much difference in the way people see it here compared to how they see it anywhere else. It is seen basically as a textbook on sex, but I don't think many people read it now. If they see it at all, they see it to look at the pictures.
Take us back almost 2,000 years to when this was written, to who wrote it and why it was written. What tradition is this part of, writing about these kind of intimate relations and the great envelope of life around them? Who and why?
Well, Tom, this book, the Kama Sutra, is written by a person called Vatsyayana. Scholars believe that he lived in India just about 2,000 years ago. And he hasn't given very many details about himself in his book, which is the only one that he has written. But he has said a little bit on the basis of which we can make a judgment as to why he wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
He says that, like other texts dealing with the different pursuits of human life, this text also has a long tradition of being commented upon by people before him. And he gives a list of names, and he gives a list of the works they have done on that. Then he says that over the years, the work had become very long, very complicated, and very difficult for people to follow. So he decided to study all the other works and to condense them into one convenient handbook, which he said he composed by himself, working very carefully on it. And he said that he has prepared this in order to help people to pursue this end of life, which is, you know, they believed in three ends of life: virtue, wealth, and pleasure. And he was concentrating on the third end. And he said the purpose is to enable people to live the life of, to pursue pleasure in life in a proper way.
It's very interesting. You remind us how of these three sort of goals or three areas that need tending in life: virtue, wealth, or your material well-being, and then pleasure, which the Kama Sutra goes to. But he well understood that there were plenty of other great works that were focused entirely on the others, on dharma, virtue, on artha, material wealth. He saw himself as writing just to one part of this trinity.
Well, you see, in fairness to the whole thing, Vatsyayana does begin his work by referring to all the three pursuits of human life.
Mm-hmm.
And then giving some details about all three of them and their interrelationship with each other and the need to pursue them all in balance, he acknowledges that all three are legitimate pursuits of human life, except that they must be pursued in a balanced way. And then he gives a list of names and authorities and texts which deal with all the other two works also. And then he says that he is going to concentrate on the subject which he has chosen to pursue, which is the subject of the pursuit of pleasure.
How did he imagine his audience? It's clearly men and women as he writes the Kama Sutra.
He hasn't specified in so many words his audience, but if you go through the work, you find that his audience is really cultivated men and women of his time. People who had leisure to lead a cultivated and an elegant life and who could benefit from what he was suggesting.
Just to give a sense of what that life must have been like, I wonder if you could read a bit for us there from Delhi. Chapter 4, he writes about the gentleman's life, and he's talking about his abode, his home. And he says, well, you know, first of all, inherit money or make money. So get yourself set up in a good town, have a house built near water, have an orchard, you know, and have a couple of bedrooms. Could you read for us from there just to get a sense of the environment of his imagining?
Well, he talks about the life of a gentleman, and after describing a house which he has built for himself, as you have just said, he then describes the inside of the house.
Please read for us.
And this is what he says.
Mm-hmm.
And now I am reading to you the words of Vatsyayan as I have translated them. The outer bedroom should have a good, soft bed, low in the middle, with two pillows and a white sheet spread over it. At its head, there is a place for a brush and a stand for keeping a pot of beeswax, a bottle of perfume, some lemon peel, and betel leaves. Creams and garlands left over from the night before can also be placed there. On the ground is a spittoon. A lute hangs from a peg of ivory on the wall. Near it, there is a drawing board with pencils, a book, and a garland of amaranth leaves. A couch is kept near the bed, and not too far from it is a round cushioned seat spread on the ground with dice and gambling boards on it. Outside the bedroom are cages for pet birds and a secluded place for wood carving and other pastimes. In the orchard, there's a padded swing in the shade, and a bench of baked clay spread with flowers.
There's Aditya Haksa reading from his new translation of the Kama Sutra, joining us today from Delhi in India. And I have to say, as I read this description of the gentleman's abode, I felt a tremendous kind of jealousy, Aditya. I don't know about you these days. Maybe you've got all these things, plus the orchard and the water nearby. But there's a presumption here of a quite comfortable material life that lies behind the instruction in how to live that he provides.
Well, that is it. You see, he, as I said, he has addressed his remarks to cultivated people, to how they should live, how they should pass their leisure times, how their romantic life should be led, on their families, how to court, how to get married, how to live in a family. Indeed, he talks about extramarital relations. And he talks about ways of making yourself more attractive, fitter, better presentable, things like that.
All of that in the Kama Sutra, just one of seven books actually dealing with the act of sex. The first book lays out this contextual background, describes the life of a gentleman, and we'll hear more about that. The third and fourth talk about courtship and marriage and the role of the wife. The fifth, it talks about extramarital relations, or this was a polygamous society very often, even harems there. We'll look at that. The sixth deals with life and the conduct of courtesans. That's a clue to a different time, maybe. And the final, this book of almost recipes for increasing attractiveness and enhancing virility and all the rest. Is it a knowable culture, a knowable time to us? Is it
similar enough to our time and culture that we can still take lessons from the Kama Sutra, Aditya?
Well, I think he was writing in a language which was obviously designed to make an impact upon the people for whom he was writing. And there is no doubt that they took note of what he did, what he said, and that they paid attention to it, because for centuries after the Kama Sutra was written, there are repeated references to it and citations of it in many other works which followed. So there's no question but it became a well-known work and an authority on this particular area of life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On this Valentine's Day, we're talking about the wisdom of the Kama Sutra, talking about everything pretty much except the explicit guidance on sex. It turns out there's a lot on how to live and love here. Aditya Huxar joins us from Delhi, India. He's out with a new translation being very well reviewed of this nearly 2,000-year-old classic. And I should say, gentle warning here, we're not really focusing on the sex side particularly this hour, but this book does get into that terrain, so heads up, it's adult subject matter. We're going to hear in just a moment from an American translator of the Kama Sutra, Wendy Doniger, but it's so great to have Mr. Huxar with us from Delhi today. He's done a wonderful translation. Aditya, how long did it take you to translate this from Sanskrit into English? Was this a work of years?
Well, Tom, I was working on the text itself, actually translating for nearly 2 years. Because, you know, translation is it's a long, drawn-out process if you want to do it properly.
You give abundant thanks in your foreword to your wife of many years, and her help in this. Did it make her blush to help you translate the Kama Sutra? Is this just what grown-ups know?
Well, she was of great help to me in my translation of the Kama Sutra, but that's not the only one in which she has helped me. I've been translating a variety of Sanskrit literature for the public of today, and she has helped me in each one of them.
I want to, if I may, just share some more of your translation with our listeners. You're talking about this, the primary target for this, though it's written as well, clearly for women, and we'll talk with Wendy about that and with Aditya Huxar. But here's describing the daily routine in this life of balance. It's a pretty nice routine of the gentleman getting up. And this is before we get into anything amorous. Just after getting up in the morning and relieving himself, a gentleman cleans his teeth and rubs some scented paste on his body, perfuming his hair with incense smoke, applying beeswax and red lac to his face, and putting on a garland. He then looks at himself in a mirror and freshens his mouth with betel leaf before attending to the day's work. Good start there. And then, he should bathe every day, have a massage every second day, and use the fishbone body scraper every third day. The nails and the whiskers should be trimmed every fourth day, and the body hair removed every fifth or tenth day. The armpits should always be kept clean of perspiration. So we're setting the stage here. And then, he should eat in the morning and the afternoon, and the evening too. After meals, he spends time making his parrots and minor birds talk, watching quail, cock, and ram fights and other similar recreation. He also interacts with his companions, parasites, we'll have to ask about that, and jesters, and then has a nap. By the late afternoon, he's dressed to go out for social gatherings and soirees. At dusk, there are concerts of music. After that, he returns to his chamber, which has meanwhile been decorated and perfumed with incense smoke, and waits there by the bedside with his aides for girlfriends coming out to meet him. A messenger woman may be sent to fetch them, or he may go himself. Once again, wow, what a life. This is not exactly just dashing off to work, dashing home, throwing down some chicken McNuggets. Aditya Huxar, translator of this new edition of the Kama Sutra, please stand by in Delhi, India. Wendy Doniger joins us now from Chicago, Sanskrit scholar and expert on Hinduism and mythology, professor of the history of religions at the University of Chicago, author of many books and translations, including her own translation of the Kama Sutra in 2003, also author of The Hindus and Alternative History. Wendy Doniger, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here, Tom.
How much is time trapped in the Kama Sutra, and how much is timeless? How much can we tap into the guidance here?
I think it has a lot to say for men and women nowadays in its psychology. The culture is strange and mysterious and ancient Indian, but the psychology is quite modern and very useful. There's a section I've always loved about how you get rid of a guy when you're tired of him, and it's advice to a woman to stop laughing at his jokes and to distort the meaning of what he says and to laugh when he hasn't made a joke and whisper about him to you. It's just a wonderful description of a very nasty woman treating a man so badly that he has to leave of his own accord, and every word of it is modern.
Help us understand this world a little bit. Aditya Huxar's translation describes the abode and the daily routine of this gentleman, and it seems kind of far from the, you know, rush of most of our lives today. It seems kind of very, very appealing, actually, if you could pull it off. But what about the women? The talk of courtesans and harems and wives, but also a polygamous culture. What about the cultural context?
The culture is not at all modern. The culture is the part that's different. The culture is the part where you say, my goodness, this is strange. It's very removed from our own. It's, first of all, a culture of great wealth and luxury and privilege. The hero of the Kama Sutra, the man about town, or the woman about town, it is really about women too. Mm-hmm. They never work. They never go visit their mom. I mean, there's just a life entirely dedicated to pleasure, which I suppose some people nowadays still live, but it's rare in our time, whereas there was a whole class in ancient India that lived that way. So to that extent, it's rare. To the fact that it's Indian and they use Indian ways of taking care of their body, that's different. But that they take care of their body is the same. So you're constantly buffeted between the strange and the familiar, which is what makes it such an exciting book to read. You keep saying, gosh, that's weird. And then you say, my goodness, I've done that.
Yeah.
And then you say, wow, this is strange. And they say, this makes sense to me. It has the two of them cheek by jowl all the time.
You say a culture devoted to pleasure, but as Aditya Huxar points out, and you see right at the top of the book, as you well know, the pursuit of virtue is also very front and center, at least as he introduces what the balanced life should be like, and taking care of your material life. It's all in there right alongside sort of intimate tips on your love.
He uses two or three lines in a very long book in which he describes the world of Dharma and the world of Artha. He kind of gets them out of the way in the beginning by acknowledging that Kama is just part of it. But then he leaves it all alone. He says, other books are about that. I'm going to tell you about Kama. So it's only a very brief introduction, which he reminds the reader what any Indian reader would have known, which is that there are serious texts devoted to Dharma and to Artha. And in fact, the Kama Sutra is rather closely modeled on the textbook of politics and wealth, the Artha Shastra. It takes its vocabulary, its form, a great deal of its psychology from the book of politics that was composed about 100 years before the Kama Sutra. So it is politically oriented in some ways, although it says very little about that, except in the book 6 about the courtesans, which is a lot about money, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the book has little, and they hardly ever mention Dharma again. From time to time, he reminds the reader of a whole other concern, but this book is not about that.
Aditya Huxar in Delhi, give us a sense then. He tells us to have a balanced life, and then he takes us into the realm of pleasure. What's the general approach to the realm of pleasure that this ancient author offers us here? How does he look at the realm of pleasure? How we should approach it?
Well, you know, he spells out, he describes what he believes pleasure to be. He says that he is talking essentially of physical pleasure, things which are congenial to a person's senses of touching, seeing, smelling, feeling, and so on. And then he describes this life in great detail, describes the life, and he gives prominence to the life of two people, a man and a woman, together. And he describes it in great detail. But he keeps saying, I don't say all the time, but at the beginning and at the end of the work,
mm-hmm.
he reverts to what he has said right at the beginning, that there are three pursuits of human life, that they are all important and all legitimate, and that they should be followed in a balanced manner. I can give you a very brief verse which he has right at the end in his epilogue.
Yes, please.
And he says, talking about the Kama Sutra, he says, one who understands its essence will look to virtue, wealth, and pleasure, his own faith, the world around him, and not act just out of passion.
Not so passion alone. No, but balance, as you say there. And I'm sorry, did you? But our phone line's a little tough there. Sometimes I'm stepping in, and I'm sorry for that. But I wanted to take it to Wendy, if I may. I mean, there's that balance, but then there's tremendous detail in the way he describes not only intimate acts, but the whole life around them. And I kept scratching my head and wondering about contemporary counterparts of this. I mean, there's all the stuff on kissing and scratching and biting and regional practices. And
yeah.
But then there's also lovers' quarrels and arranging a marriage and, you know, the nature of women and men and making a pass and appraisal of feelings and right on down. Do we have a counterpart of this kind of work or guidance today? Is it Cosmo magazine at some level? Is it something else, Wendy?
I think the closest thing we have to that kind of insight today is good novels. I think the kind of description of daily life and the description of psychology that you get in something like a John Updike novel or a Philip Roth novel is the kind of insight and the kind of good writing, too, that you get here. It's not Masters and Johnson. I mean, just as you yourself pointed out, a very, very... There are seven books of the Kama Sutra. Each has around five or six chapters. One of those books is about lovemaking, and one of those chapters within that one book is about the positions, the famous, notorious positions.
Right.
So the Kama Sutra is really not about that. The rest of the book is really about the psychology of sexual attraction, but it's about as you say, it's also about society, how to manage the household. Masters and Johnson and all of that does not begin to the joy of sex, Alex Comfort. None of that begins to approach the scope of the Kama Sutra. I think you really need to look for it in good novels.
I wonder if you could read a little bit for us, Wendy, from, and if you'd be gracious enough to read from Adichie's, Huxar's translation here. There's a section on the benefits of learning for women, and it's really interesting. It gives you a sense of the cultural context around this. I wonder if you could take us in there, Wendy.
Well, it's really about the kind of extreme the learning of the 64 arts, the extreme cultivation that a very small class of women had, which were the elite courtesans, the highest level courtesans. So this is what he says about this. And Aditya calls them public women, but I call them courtesans.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm reading his translation.
Mm-hmm.
A public woman who excels in these arts and is possessed of character, good looks, and merit wins the name elite courtesan and a place in people's assemblies. Always honored by the king and praised by men of quality, she becomes a focal point for requests and supplications and intimate approaches. A princess or a minister's daughter who knows these arts can win control of her husband even though his harem have 1,000 women. And separated from her lord, fallen into dire straits, even in a foreign land, with these skills she will be able still to lead a life of comfort. And then he goes on to say about what a man can do. And in these arts, adept, a man who's good with words and flattery will quickly win the hearts of women, a stranger to them though he may be. Luck in love can come about with just a knowledge of these arts, but one must also take into account time and place to see if they can be put to use or not.
Wendy Doniger reading there from Aditya Huxar's new translation of the Kama Sutra. How did you describe for us the courtesans of this era? Was it what kind of social standing did they have? How did they live? Who were they?
Well, Tom, I think that they had something in common with what we have read, what I have read in other world literatures about the hetaira in ancient Greece and about the geisha in Japan.
Okay.
They were women of culture, of good standing, who led an active social life with men, who lived well, and who not only spent their time in activities of pleasure, but also took part in cultural and social life of their times, as we know from other works.
So they were
the best example that we have in history of a courtesan is from the time of the Buddha, the courtesan Amrapali, with whom the Buddha had to interact with, which I would say is, let's say, 600 or 700 years or 800 years before the time of Vatsyayana. So this was an institution which was a very old one, and Vatsyayana devotes a whole book to how these women lived, how they managed their affairs, and how they brought up their families. It talks about their children, their marriages, and how they arranged for them. And it describes them in great length, and they were very much a part of that society. They were not people who were sort of kept out, not talked about, something looked down upon. They were as much a part of society as anyone else.
A special status there. Wendy, are there slippers in the Kama Sutra for a regular woman, contemporary woman today, to put on and find familiar to as she reads here?
Oh, I think there very much are those places. Ironically, I think the chapter on the courtesans has the most relevant advice for women of today, if you set aside the issue that money is changing hands, because the courtesans are free to choose their partner, sexual partners, and they are economically independent, as most modern women are, whereas the women in Book 4, for instance, the wives, have none of these privileges and are enormously constrained socially. So if you set aside the money part, it's the psychology. For instance, that the passage I mentioned in which she gets rid of a lover she's tired of, that's a courtesan. A wife does not so easily get rid of a husband she's tired of. So it's chapter 6, the courtesan, book 6, the book about the courtesans, which I think has the most to say to modern women, and in the same way to modern men. Those are the relationships we really deal with, and again, with the exception of the fact that money does not usually pass, change hands.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the wisdom of the Kama Sutra on this Valentine's Day, talking about everything, and there's a lot here pretty much, but we're talking about everything more or less except the explicit sexual guidance. It turns out there's a great deal on how to live in the Kama Sutra about relations between men and women, men and their friends, women and their world of nearly 2,000 years ago, a lot that's relevant today. Wendy Doniger joins us from the University of Chicago today. She's has her own translation of the Kama Sutra out in 2003, also author of The Hindus, and from Delhi in India, the author of the latest translation of the ancient text. Aditya Haksar joins us. He is a long-time diplomat who's translated a lot from Sanskrit. You can read an excerpt of his new translation at our website, onpointradio.org. And I also should say that though it's not our focus today, this is a book with adult content, and there are some references to it in this conversation. So heads up on that. Let's go to our listeners. Brattleboro, Vermont, Micah's calling. Hi, Micah. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So you asked a question near the beginning of the program, you know, what was my or our first experience with the Kama Sutra, or, you know, when do we first remember hearing about it,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah.
My first notable memory of the Kama Sutra actually was in my early 20s. I spent a little time at a conservative Christian Bible college, and I had taken a historical survey course on human love. It included things like Kama Sutra and Song of Solomon, things like that. And it specifically excluded love in the divine sense, simply human love. How it is that love has stayed the same and changed over, you know, the past. Actually, the survey went back prior to the dates when.
We're talking millennia here, over a long time. And how was the Kama Sutra presented in a conservative Christian college, Micah?
Oh, unabashedly, it was presented as a good depiction of kind of human nature. It wasn't clouded or shrouded in any way. You might think that, you know, in a conservative school, you know, all the sex stuff would be kind of, you know, maybe we'll just skip that chapter or something like that. But it wasn't at all.
And did you find it useful in figuring out how to live?
Well, I did. It more so the other books, rather than just the sex book. A lot of the things that are outlined are so congruent with my own personal perspective being the Bible, but also very congruent with even things like you know, Aristotelian thought and different philosophies and understood psychologies of 2,000 years ago, and then even today. It's all so very similar, and a lot of people I find kind of nitpick some of these higher level differences rather than looking at the details and saying this isn't really hugely different.
There's a lot that's universal in those details. Mike, I appreciate your call. I mean, Wendy, you know, there's Micah's introduction to the Kama Sutra. I well remember my own. I was a teenager heading off to India with my girlfriend, now mother of all my children. We just about burned down the reading room reading this thing in the university library. It was hot stuff. But I wonder how Western society overall came to know the Kama Sutra. What about the Richard Burton story and his translation? How did it unfold? It wasn't formally, publicly published until the 1960s, I think, Wendy.
It was not legally published until the 1960s. It was published. Burton was a great connoisseur of sexual writings from a lot of different cultures. Arabic was the one he really knew best. He didn't know Sanskrit. He actually got somebody else to translate the book for him and then tidied it up in his elegant prose. So he published his privately with a private press that he made up, and he pretended had its printing presses in Constantinople or some places, really in a London basement. And it became immediately the most pirated book in the English language.
Wow.
This was 1883.
Yeah.
And immediately it was republished. And to this day, it is widely used because, of course, it's free since it's in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, it was free too since it was illegal. So anyone who wanted to could just simply reprint the Burton translation, and there were copies all over the place illegally. And finally, as late as 1962, it's really amazing, it became legal in the United States, and then finally had scholarly editions. Otherwise, scholars never bothered with it. But there was a German translation early in the in the 20th century, a very good German translation, but he put into Latin all the bits that dealt with anything sexually explicit.
Right,
so
right.
You had to know German and Latin to read that one. So people didn't bother with that. They just read the Burton translation.
Aditya Haksar, in Delhi, I know you've looked at many translations. What do you think of the Richard Burton translation at this point? The original, I guess, in English, that's so widely pirated, as Wendy says. How does it sound or read to your eye and ear these days?
Well, it has a Victorian taste, and a Victorian taste is still very attractive. And there's no question. I believe that the Burton translation is the one which has the widest circulation so far. One reason, perhaps, as you've been told, is because it's in the public domain and you can get it printed and reprinted all over the place. But it certainly has its attraction.
But it's wrong.
Wrong in what way, Wendy?
I mean, there are many mistakes in the translation, as Aditya must know. Burton got things wrong. He worked with some pundits. It's hard to tell who actually got it wrong since it wasn't Burton's translation, but he read it through Victorian eyes in such a way that he removes, for instance, all the female agency, puts everything in the indirect discourse where there are actually voices of women being quoted. He puts it all, the woman speaks about these qualities and so forth. So he rephrases it. And he makes some interesting mistakes. There's a wonderful passage in which the Sanskrit text says that if a woman has reason to believe that her husband is unfaithful to her, she can berate him about it in public. And Burton inserts the word not. She should not berate him in public, he says. And then the Sanskrit goes on to say that she could, if she wanted to, use black magic against him, but that one shouldn't do that because it kind of ruins the faith in a, confidence in a marriage. And Burton leaves that entirely and says she should not be a nag or something of that sort. So he mutes some important passages in which women stand up for their rights.
Victorian in that way as well. AJ in Chesapeake, Virginia. AJ, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if your guest could expound on how the Kama Sutra was received in its day. Was it considered supportive of the status quo and a general diminished view of women, or was it considered rebellious and maybe revolutionary?
Aditya Haksar, was this revolutionary in its day or sort of a familiar kind of advice?
Well, Tom, one can, of course, go in for guesswork and try to make some conclusion on that basis. But if you go on the basis of the textual evidence which is available, and I think I've mentioned this in the introduction to my translation, perhaps within a year, within a century or two after the Kama Sutra, was written a book of fables for instructing children, really, in which there is a reference to the Kama Sutra and to Vatsyayana. And the impression one gets from that is that it was considered to be a part of the educational, general education of a cultivated person. Just as a cultivated person was supposed to have some knowledge of the other ends of life and the literature written about them, he was also expected to know something about the science of pleasure. And I think it was received in that path, in that context. And subsequently, of course, as I've mentioned, there have been, over the centuries, references to the Kama Sutra in many other works of literature, which all bear out that it was considered to be a kind of a...
Wendy, there's really...
An exposition on... leading the good life.
The good life. So a kind of almost a standard handbook in a way, but it gets into really intimate human dynamics here, Wendy. I'm looking here at the work of helpers and messengers, and it writes about permissible women, women with whom one may sleep. It talks about three kinds: virgin, previously married, courtesan, and then a fourth kind is other. Women are married to other men, and it's so practical. It's almost Machiavellian, you know. It says, okay, for example, her husband is influential, but he's under her control. She dominates him. She can turn him against her, against me, or toward my adversaries. So sleep with her and gain her favor, and it may push me ahead in the world. Or, you know, or there's no sin in sleeping with her, as I have no money. I have few means of livelihood, and in this way, sleeping with her, I might stand to gain enormous wealth without any difficulty. So, okay. We'll do it in that case. It gets into these human dynamics, Wendy.
It's one of my favorite passages, the ones you're quoting, where he imagines all the reasons that there are to break the rule against sleeping with another man's wife, which was a basic rule. If we're talking about Dharma, there is no adultery. There should be no adultery. It is against
Dharma. Virtue.
Mm-hmm. Against virtue, against morality, and that he speaks about in the beginning. Yet, chapter 5, one of the longest chapters, is all about how to commit adultery. And at the very end, he says, of course, one should never really commit adultery. I'm just telling you how people do commit adultery so that you can guard against it, which is a very thin excuse, I think. I mean, it's a very detailed study of adultery. And your question about how it was received, the imagery in it and the descriptions are used in literature a great deal. Not just, we don't know, as Aditya rightly says, we don't know that much about what went on in real life, but we do know that literature quotes the Kama Sutra all the time. And the theme of adultery is a major theme in in all literature. Saul Bellow once said, can you have a circus without elephants? You can't have a novel without adultery. Adultery is always a part of the literature of India, and it's also part of the religious metaphors of India. Sexual unfaithfulness is a metaphor for losing contact with your God in the devotional literature. So the Kama Sutra gets into religion, religious texts, passionate love lyrics of the type of the Song of Solomon that the gentleman from Vermont mentioned as well, the Song of Songs, where simultaneously you're talking about the love of God and the love of a human lover. And the Kama Sutra comes into all of that as well. And the psychology, that passage you read about adultery ends with the statement, these are all the reasons why you might sleep with another man's wife, despite the fact that it's a violation of virtue, of dharma. But the one reason you must never do it is for passion.
Right, not that passion not alone.
passion alone is not a reason to commit adultery. It has to be justified by some other material gains of some sort.
He talks
it's
about
a very cynical book.
Well, yes, but also very attuned to human behavior, as we know it widely practiced. He talks in these women, the kind of women you may sleep with. He also talks about. He says there are four. Four different kinds. Then there's a fifth kind. Some believe a person of the third nature. What's that, Wendy?
The third nature is one of the most interesting passages in the Kama Sutra, and when you talk about whether it's revolutionary or not, that passage, I think, is indeed revolutionary, indeed unique in Indian literature of the ancient period and the medieval period, in making a non-judgmental statement that there are men who have sex with other men. And some of them dress as women, some of them dress as men. He simply describes them. He says these are people of the third nature, the first two natures being presumably male and female. He describes them, he describes what they do, and then he moves on to other subjects without any opprobrium at all. And other Sanskrit texts speak of such people with scorn and derision and absolute disapproval. There's a greatly homophobic quality of ancient Sanskrit literature, except for this one long passage in the Kama Sutra. So it's a revolution, but in a sense, it's a revolution that never happened. Subsequent texts don't pick up that part of the Kama Sutra. The people of the third nature are referred to quite often in Indian literature, but never described as the Kama Sutra describes them, and never described as positively as the Kama Sutra describes them.
Let me go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and John. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You asked earlier if there was someone who had gotten instruction from the Kama Sutra.
Okay.
When my wife and I, Marguerite, were students at Duquesne University, she got a scholarship to go to the University of Madrid. I got to go to Washington University in St. Louis, and we were separated for 7 weeks.
Okay.
We used the Kama Sutra as our instruction because there's a section on how to have a reunion with someone you've been separated from for a long time.
Okay, I'm bracing here. Be careful with us now, John. How was it?
It's the social part. It's the gentlemanly and womanly part rather than the sexual part.
Okay.
So relax. And it says, don't throw a big party, don't have a lot of people around, make sure you have a private time, separate from everyone else, tell each other what you've been doing, become reacquainted and re-familiar and re-harmonized. And so we took that lead. And she came in on a flight in the morning, and we told her parents and my parents she was coming in the late afternoon. We met at the airport, had a meal and some wine, enjoyed our romantic reunion, talked with each other about what we had been done that we hadn't shared already in letters. And it wasn't until late afternoon that I made a call after we took care of our Chapter 2 part of the Kama Sutra and told our parents that Marguerite's in the shower, she's home from the airport, we'll be in touch with you, we'll get together for dinner.
Everything in order, and according to the ancient order of the Kama Sutra. It sounds like that was pretty good advice, John. Pretty good advice indeed.
Exquisite advice.
I want to read just a little more from Aditya Haksar's translation here. This is on reviving passion. And it goes to the kind of sense of respect, mutual respect that I found in this wonderful translation. It says, even at its ending, pleasure still nurtured with caring acts and words exchanged in confidence causes a supreme delight, responding to each other's feelings which inspire mutual pleasure. Aditya Haksar in Delhi, there is a kind of, our time is short, but there's a kind of respect for one, people one among another in the Kama Sutra here that I found very appealing.
Well, you know, it so happened that the current preoccupation with Book 2 of the Kama Sutra and all the pictorial representations and so on of the copulatory act have tended to, as it were, overshadow these other aspects of this great book. And those are the aspects which deal with social relations, relations between men and women and others, relations which emphasize mutual caring.
And respect, respect right there. Aditya Haksar in Delhi with the new translation of the Kama Sutra. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got to leave it there. And Wendy Doniger, University of Chicago, thanks to you as well, Wendy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.